I've been in Minneapolis for just over 15 hours. Driven from the southern suburbs to the northern ones, dropped off a half a dozen apps, and undergone two face-to-face interviews. Job searches take their toll, even in the case of totally honest applicants, and I am feeling particularly damaged. The personality tests, for example. The truth is, I don't much care if my fellow workers are getting high in the parking lot, or even lifting the occasional retail item, and I certainly wouldn't snitch if I did. Nor do I believe that management rules by divine right, or the undiluted force of superior knowledge, as the surveys demand you acknowledge. It whittles you down to lie up to 50 times in the space of the 15 minutes or so it takes to do a survey, even when there's a higher moral purpose to serve. Equally draining is the effort to look both perky and compliant at the same time, for half an hour or more at a stretch, because while you need to evince initiative, you don't want to come across as someone who might initiate something like a union organizing drive. Then there's the threat of the drug tests hanging over me like a fast-approaching SAT. It rankles at some deep, personal, physical level to know that the many engaging qualities I believe I have to offer, friendliness, reliability, willingness to learn, can all be trumped by my P. There are many claims for workplace drug testing. Supposedly, it results in reduced rates of accidents and absenteeism, fewer claims on health insurance plans, and increased productivity. However, none of these claims has been substantiated, according to a 1999 report from the American Civil Liberties Union. Studies show that pre-employment testing does not lower absenteeism, accidents, or turnover, and, at least in the high-tech workplaces studied, actually lowered productivity, presumably due to its negative effect on employee morale. Furthermore, the practice is quite costly. In 1990, the federal government spent $11.7 million to test 29,000 federal employees. Since only 153 tested positive, the cost of detecting a single drug user was $77,000. Why do employers persist in the practice? Probably in part because of advertising by the roughly $2 billion drug testing industry. But I suspect that the demeaning effect of testing may also hold some attraction for employers. In a spirit of contrition for multiple sins, I decide to devote the weekend to detox. A web search reveals that I'm on a heavily traveled path. There are dozens of sites offering help to the would-be drug test passer, mostly in the form of ingestible products, though one site promises to send a vial of pure, drug-free urine, battery-heated to body temperature. Since I don't have time to order and receive any drug test evasion products, I linger over a site in which hundreds of letters, typically with subject lines reading, "Help! Test in 3 days," are soberly answered by Alec. Here I learn that my leanness is an advantage. There aren't too many places for the cannabis derivatives to hide out in, and that the only effective method is to flush the damn stuff out with massive quantities of fluid, at least 3 gallons a day. To hurry the process, there's a product called Clean Pee, supposedly available at GNC. So I drive 15 minutes to the nearest one, swigging tap water from an Evian bottle all the way, and ask the kid manning the place where his, detox products are kept. Maybe he's used to a stream of mom-like women demanding Clean Pee, because he leads me, poker-faced, to an impressively large locked glass case. Locked, either because the average price of GNC's detox products is $49.95, or because the market is thought to consist of desperate and not particularly law-abiding individuals. I read the ingredients and buy two of them separately, creatinine and a diuretic called Uva Ursus, for a total of $30. So, here's the program. Drink water at all times, along with frequent doses of diuretic, and, This is my own scientific contribution. Avoid salt in any form at all, since salt encourages water retention, meaning no processed foods, fast foods, or condiments of any kind. If I want that job in plumbing at Menards, I have to make myself into an unobstructed pipe. Water in, and water just as pure and drinkable coming out. My other task for Saturday is to find a place to live. I go through all the apartment-finding agencies in the phone book, Apartment March, Apartment Search, Apartments Available, and so on, and leave messages. I also try all the apartment buildings listed, finding, at the two buildings where someone actually answers, that they want 12-month leases. I walk to the supermarket to pick up the Sunday paper, pausing to apply for a job while I'm there. Yes, they could use someone. Things get pretty hectic around the first of the month, right after the welfare checks go out. I can come back next week. The newspaper, though, is a disappointment. There is exactly one furnished studio apartment listed for the entire Twin Cities area, and they're not answering the phone on the weekend. Maybe, though, given the incipient incontinence induced by the flush-out regimen, it's just as well I have no apartments to see. Dinner is a quarter of a barbecued chicken from the supermarket, unsalted and washed down with a familiar low-tech diuretic, beer. This is not, all things considered, my finest hour. If I could just surrender to my increasingly aqueous condition and wait out the weekend with a novel, things would be looking up. But home, in this instance, is not a restful place. It's more like what is known in the military as a situation. When I am home, Budgie wants to be out of his cage, a desire he makes known by squawking or, what is far worse, by pacing dementedly. When he's out of his cage, he wants to sit on my head and worry my hair and my glasses frames. To minimize the damage, I don't let him out unless I'm wearing my hooded sweatshirt, tied up tight enough to cover my hair and most of my face, and still I am constantly having to move him from his favorite face-to-face perch on my shoulder to, say, my forearm, from which he will work his way ineluctably back to my face. This is what anyone coming to the door would encounter. A cringing figure, glasses peering out the porthole of her sweatshirt, topped by a large crested, and I can only imagine quite pleased with its dominant position, exotic white bird. But I can't incarcerate him nearly as much as I'd like to. It's my job, isn't it? My way of earning my shelter, to be this creature's friend and surrogate flock. Unfortunately, Budgie does not serve the same functions for me. And on Sunday, I decide to seek out my own kind. A New York friend, a young African-American feminist, had urged me to look up her aunt in Minneapolis, and I have reason beyond sociability for doing so. I've been worrying that the scenario I've created for myself, both here and in Maine, is totally artificial. Who, in real life, plops herself down in a totally strange environment, without housing, family connections, or job, and attempts to become a viable resident? Well, it turns out that my friend's aunt did exactly that in the early 90s. Got on a Greyhound bus in New York with two children in tow, disembarking in the utterly strange state of Florida. This is a story I have to hear, so I call and get a wary invitation to come on over this afternoon. Caroline, as I'll call her, is a commanding presence, with high cheekbones and quick-moving shamanistic eyes. She gets me my drink du jour, water, introduces me to her children, and explains that it's her husband's day off, which he's spending upstairs in bed. The house, well, she apologizes for it, though three bedrooms in a freestanding building for $825 a month doesn't seem so bad to me at the moment. She itemizes its deficiencies. The bedrooms are tiny, The block is infested with drug dealers. The dining room ceiling leaks whenever the bathroom above it is used. The toilet can be flushed only by pouring in a bucket of water. And why are they here? Because on her $9 an hour as an assistant bookkeeper at a downtown hotel, plus her husband's $10 as a maintenance worker, minus utilities and $59 a week for health insurance, she's diabetic, the 5-year-old asthmatic. This is what you get. Yet, if you do the arithmetic, these people are earning nearly $40,000 a year, which makes them officially middle class. I explain my mission in Minneapolis, although it turns out her niece has already briefed her, and ask her to tell me about her move to Florida 10 years ago. This is the story, more or less as it emerged, since she didn't mind my taking notes, of someone doing in real life what I am doing only in the service of journalism. She'd been living in New Jersey, working at a bank, when she decided to leave her husband because he wasn't involved with the children. She moved in with her mother in Queens, but found it impossible to get to her job in New Jersey from there, in addition to taking her youngest child to daycare every morning. Then her brother moved in, so you had 3 adults and 2 children in a 2-bedroom apartment, which was just not working out. So she decided to take off for Florida, where she had heard the rents were lower. What she had was their clothes, the Greyhound tickets, and $1,600 in cash. That was all. They got off the bus in a town a little south of Orlando, and here a nice cab driver, she still remembers his name, took them to a low-priced hotel. The next step was to find a church. Always find a church. People from the church drove her around to the WIC office, Women, Infants, and Children, a federal program offering food help to pregnant women and mothers of young children, and to find a school for her 12-year-old girl and daycare for the baby. Sometimes they also helped with groceries. Soon, Caroline got a job cleaning hotel rooms, 28 to 30 rooms a day for $2 to $3 a room, for a total of about $300 a week. It was go to bed with a backache and wake up with a backache. The little girl had to pick up the baby at daycare and watch him until Caroline got home at about 8 o'clock p.m., which means she didn't get much chance to go outside and play. What was it like to start all over in a completely new place? Anxiety attack, you know what I'm saying? It was the stress, she thinks, that gave her diabetes. There she was, thirsty all the time, blurry vision, a terrible itching of her privates, and she had no idea what the symptoms meant. One doctor told her it had to be an STD, but it had been a long, long time since any sex had occurred. One morning, the Lord told her, "Go to a hospital. Walk. Don't ride." She walked 30 blocks and passed out at the hospital. Maybe the Lord wanted her to walk so she'd pass out and finally get some attention. There were good things that happened, though. She used to help a man at the hotel where she cleaned, a man who was sick with cancer, bringing him food and even cleaning the bad-smelling sores, and he was so grateful that he once gave her $325, which he knew was the exact amount of her rent. And there was one major friend, Irene, whom Caroline met at a dumpster. Irene had problems, yes. She was both black and Indian, a migrant farm worker, and had been raped by someone and also abused by her boyfriend, who left an ugly scar on her face. The boyfriend found the rapist and hacked him to death and ended up permanently in prison. So Caroline took Irene in, and for a while it worked out very well. Irene got a job at Taco Bell and helped with the kids, whom she fussed over and loved as her own. Then Irene started drinking and dancing on chairs in bars, finally leaving to live with a man. Caroline misses her, and even went back to Florida once to try to find her. She could have died. One time, a cancer the size of a quarter popped out of her right nipple. It's hard not knowing. It was in Florida that Caroline met the current husband, a white man, as it turns out. And her tribulations didn't end with marriage, but went on to include bouts of homelessness and a lot more interstate travel by Greyhound with children. When, after 2 hours, I get up to go, Caroline asks if I'm a vegetarian. I apologize for not being one, and she rushes into the kitchen, coming back with a family-sized container of her homemade chicken stew, which I accept with heartfelt gratitude. Dinner. We hug. She walks me to my car, and we hug again. So, I have a friend now in Minneapolis. And the odd thing is that she is the original. The woman who uprooted herself and came out somehow on her feet, and who did all this in real life and with children, while I am the imitation, the pallid, child-free pretender. But on Tuesday, when the post-Memorial Day week begins, my life seems real enough again in a gray and baleful way. This is my day of drug tests, also of traffic, and a steady, appropriately sphincter-relaxing rain. The first test, for Walmart, is painless enough. Conducted at a chiropractor's office a few miles down the highway from Walmart itself. I'm given two plastic containers, one to pee into and one to hold the decanted sample, and sent down the hall to an ordinary public restroom. Easy enough to substitute someone else's pee, if I'd had a vial of it in my pocket, or met a potential donor in the restroom. The next test, for Menards, takes me to the southwestern suburbs, to a regular allopathic hospital, complete with patients being whisked around corridors on gurneys. A dozen people are already ahead of me in the waiting room of the Smith Klein Beecham suite I've been sent to. Most of them, judging from the usual class cues, of the low-wage variety. The waiting room TV is tuned to Robin Givens' talk show, Forgive or Forget, where today's theme is, You Took Me In and I Cleaned You Out. Seems 18-year-old Corey stole from the cousin who took him in, thus ruining Christmas for the cousin's girlfriend and her child. Corey is not repentant. In fact, makes excuses about having had to cheat and steal all the way up from the projects. That's how his life has been. Robin beats the air with her fists and yells, Corey, Corey, stop being a victim! Thievery is nothing, apparently, compared to the crime of victimhood. With each fresh denunciation of Corey, the studio audience applauds more excitedly. He is bad, as are some of the impassive viewers right in this room, who will soon be judged and exposed by their urine. My mind slides back to one of the approve/disapprove statements on the Walmart survey. There is room in every corporation for a nonconformist. But no, no, no. The correct answer, as we will all find out soon enough, is totally disagree. Finally, after 40 minutes, I am called out of the waiting room by an officious woman in blue scrubs. What are they planning? To cut out my bladder if I fail to produce a testable volume of pee? I ask whether they do anything but drug testing here. No, that's pretty much it. She checks my photo ID, then squirts what looks like soap onto my palms, although there is no sink in evidence. Now I'm to go into a bathroom and wash with water while she waits, leaving my purse with her. I pause for a beat or two, goo-filled hands held out, pondering the issues of trust that have arisen between her and me. Why, for example, am I supposed to leave her with my purse, while she doesn't even trust me not to sprinkle some drug-dissolving substance into my urine? But, for all I know, any display of attitude might lead her to slant the results. So I go meekly into the restroom, wash my hands, and then pee, which I am allowed to do with the door shut, and our little parody of medical care is complete. The whole venture, including drive time and wait, has taken an hour and 40 minutes, about what it took for the Walmart test, And it occurs to me that one of the effects of drug testing is to limit worker mobility, maybe even one of the functions. Each potential new job requires, one, the application, two, the interview, and three, the drug test. Which is something to ponder with gasoline running at nearly $2 a gallon, not to mention what you may have to pay for a babysitter. Until I know the drug test results, I feel obliged to keep looking for jobs. Most of my encounters are predictable and unpromising. Fill out the app, get told to wait for a call, etc. But one stands out from the corporate, legalistic, euphemistic, and thoroughly above-board feel of all the others. The ad is for customer service work, a type of job I tend to avoid because it normally involves a resume, which in turn would involve levels of prevarication I'm not prepared to attempt. But this customer service job is described as entry level. When I call, I'm told to come in at 3 sharp and be sure to dress professional. The latter injunction presents a challenge, since my wardrobe consists of t-shirts and only 2 pairs of pants other than blue jeans. But I have a jacket and decent shoes brought along for a stop in New York on the way to Minneapolis. And this, fortified with lipstick and knee highs, makes for a pretty damn impressive getup, I think. When I arrive at Mountain Air, as we'll call it, in a characterless white box building just off a service road, 9 other applicants are already waiting. It turns out this is a group interview, conducted by Todd in a large room, where we applicants sit in folding chairs while Todd, a sharply dressed fellow of about 30, lectures and shows transparencies. Todd speaks very rapidly in a sing-song cadence, suggesting that he does this several times a day. Mountain Air, he says, is an environmental consulting firm, offering help to people with asthma and allergies as a free service. We will be sent out to the sufferers in our own cars, making $1,650 if we complete 54 2-hour appointments in 30 days. Though you'd have to be pretty lazy to make only that much. Plus, there are incredible perks like weekend training sessions held all over the country, where they get stuff done, of course, like hearing motivational speakers, but you can bring your spouse and have a great time. All we have to be is 18 or older, bondable, possessing a car and a home phone, and having 1 year of Minnesota residency. Whoops. He asks if any of us are not long-term Minnesota residents, and when I raise my hand, he says the requirement can sometimes be waived. What Mountain Air is really looking for is, and here he reads from a transparency, self-disciplined / money-motivated / positive attitude. Nothing, I note, about providing a service or healing the sick. In fact, compared with Walmart's unctuous service ethic, Todd's emphasis on the bottom line is positively refreshing. We will be independent contractors, he tells us, not employees, which means if you lie to a customer, the company is not responsible. Even, I wonder, if the lies are part of the sales pitch the company has taught you? It's very simple, Todd assures us. Just a matter of taking people who have a very serious problem, though probably not anywhere near as serious as they think it is, and leaving them happy. Any questions? None of this has made any sense to me at all, but I limit myself to asking what the product is, assuming there is some kind of product involved. Todd opens a cardboard box that I'd not noticed sitting on the floor near his feet. A squat, slightly menacing-looking appliance he introduces as the Filter Queen. So this is a selling job? Someone asks. No, Todd says with some vehemence. We have a product, and if they want it, we give it to them. Though he can't mean give it to them for free. Now we are to have our personal 3-minute interviews. When my turn comes, he asks why I want to do this, and I say something without thinking about wanting to help people with asthma. Where do I think I am? Walmart? Because when I call at the designated time 2 hours later, I'm told there's no job for me now, although I have made it to the waiting list. Maybe it was the residency issue that did me in, though I suspect it was the misplaced hypocrisy. Meanwhile, there is the increasingly desperate apartment search. Whatever else I'm doing at any point in this story, you need to picture me waiting for a call or looking for a chance to call some rental agency for a second or third or fourth time. Now that we're into the weekdays, I sometimes get live humans on the other end of the line, but they are disdainful or discouraging. One directs me to a throwaway apartment directory available in boxes on the sidewalk, but its offerings all include hot tubs and on-site gyms and go for over $1,000 a month. Another tells me that I've picked a bad time to come to Minneapolis. The vacancy rate is less than 1%. And if we're talking about affordable, why, it might be as low as a tenth of that. Listings in the Star Tribune are meager or non-existent. No one returns my calls. Besides, it is dawning on me belatedly that Minneapolis is far vaster than Key West or Portland, Maine, and that my two live job possibilities, Walmart and Menards, are separated by about 30 miles. My appetite for navigating the Twin Cities highways has been dwindling rapidly. Everywhere I go, some fellow or other who has never heard of Minnesota Nice is stalking me in his pickup truck, making me covet the bumper sticker I see more than once. If you're not a hemorrhoid, get off my ass. Nor is the leading classic rock station turning out to be sufficiently supportive. I can handle 75-mile-per-hour tailgaters on Creedence Clearwater Revival or even ZZ Top, but the Eagles and the Doobie Brothers are just no help. So one thing I do not want is to live at a hair-raising distance from my job, assuming, of course, that I get a job. There is one possibility. One place in the entire Twin Cities that rents affordable furnished apartments on a weekly or monthly basis. And this place, the Hopkins Park Plaza, becomes the focus of my residential yearnings for the next 3 weeks, my personal Shangri-La. On my third call, the first two calls were not returned, I reach Hildy, who doesn't think there's anything at the moment, but I might as well come out and pay the application fee, which is $20 in cash. When I find the couple of two-story brick buildings that constitute the Park Plaza, several other apartment seekers, a middle-aged white guy with auburn-dyed hair, a young Hispanic man, it's Latino in California, Hispanic here, an older white woman, are waiting for Hildy too, which explains why she doesn't return calls. The market is entirely on her side. The place, when I finally get taken around by Hildy, seems okay, although the corridors tend to be dark, noisy, and permeated with kitchen waste smells. I can have a room without a kitchenette right now if I want, but it's in the basement and the price, $144 a week, seems a little steep. So I decide to wait for one with a kitchenette to open up. Any day now, Hildy assures me. Turnover is dependably high. This seems like a prudent and thrifty decision at the moment, but it turns out to be a major mistake. I decide there must be something I'm doing wrong, some cue I am missing. Budgie's owners had been confident that apartment search would find me a place. When I call another friend of a friend, a professor at a college in St. Paul who has briefed me on the Twin Cities industrial history, he concedes to being aware of an affordable housing crisis, but has no idea what I should do. Those rental agents who are kind enough to talk to me at all recommend the same thing. Find a motel that rents by the week and stay there until something opens up. So, through multiple calls, I arrive at a list of 11 motels in the Twin Cities area, all of them of the non-brand name variety, offering weekly rates. The rates, though, are not anybody's definition of affordable, ranging from $200 a week at the Hillview in Shakopee to 295 at the Twin Lakes in southern Minneapolis, and many of these places are full. I head for the Hillview, which wants a $60 cash deposit. I drive and I drive. I go off the map. I leave suburbs and commercial strips far behind. I enter the open fields, which makes for a nice change driving-wise, but to live in? The vicinity of the Hillview contains no diners, no fast food joints or grocery stores, no commercial establishments at all, except for a couple of agricultural equipment warehouses. The distance is unacceptable, as is the room when I get to see it. No microwave, no fridge, hardly any space not occupied by the bed. And what would I do if I didn't feel like being in bed? Invite myself in for a tour of the Caterpillar Parts warehouse? Twin Lakes, not its real name, is at least in Minneapolis. There, the East Indian owner tells me that all his residents are long-term working people, and that I can have a room on the second floor where I won't have to keep the drapes shut during the day for privacy. Again, no fridge or microwave. Weekly, I tell him I'll take it and we'll move in a couple of days. No problem. He even waives the deposit. But I have a bad feeling about the place. Partly because everything looks gray and stained, and partly because there's a deranged-looking guy hanging out by the coin-op washer-dryer who follows me with bloodshot blue eyes. The last few years have seen a steady decline in the number of affordable apartments nationwide. In 1991, there were 47 affordable rental units available to every 100 low-income families, while by 1997, there were only 36 such units for every 100 families. No national or even reliable local statistics are available. But apparently, more and more of the poor have been reduced to living in motels. Census takers distinguish between standard motels, such as those that tourists stay in, and residential motels, which rent on a weekly basis, usually to long-term tenants. But many motels contain mixed populations or change from one type to the other depending on the season. Long-term motel residents are almost certainly undercounted, since motel owners often deny access to census takers, and the residents themselves may be reluctant to admit they live in motels, crowded in with as many as four people or more to a room. On the job front, though, things are moving along briskly. I had been told at Menards to show up for orientation at 10 o'clock Wednesday morning, and since I assume that my being hired is conditional on passing the drug test, I call to confirm the appointment. Yes, they're expecting me. I hope not just for the purpose of denouncing me as a chemical misfit. But the orientation is friendly and upbeat. Leanne, a worn-looking blonde in her 40s, and I sit across a table from Walt, who lays out the main points in a jolly, offhand way. Be nice to the guests, even when they get irate because they can't return things. And they're always trying to return things. Don't be absent without calling in. Watch out for a certain top manager who hits on women when he visits the store and generally acts like a shit. We will need to wear belts, to which a knife, for opening cardboard boxes, I suppose, and a tape measure will be attached, and the cost of these items, which he pushes across the table to us, will be deducted from our first paycheck. And, oh yes, we will be getting little presents now and then. Ballpoint pens, coffee mugs, T-shirts promoting seasonal items. Then Walt hands us our vests and our ID badges, and I'm touched to see that he's made up two for me, one with Barbara and another with Barb. I can take my choice. When Walt leaves the room for a moment, I turn to Leanne and say, "Does this mean we're hired?" Because it seems odd to me that no offer has been made or accepted. "Looks like," she says, and tells me that she hasn't even taken her drug test. She went to the testing place, but she didn't have any photo ID because her wallet was stolen, and, of course, they wouldn't test her without photo ID. Then Walt comes back and takes me out on the floor to meet Steve, a really great guy, who will be my supervisor in plumbing. But here, on the sales floor, doubt rushes in. The shelves of plumbing equipment, and there seem to be acres of them, contain not a single item I can name, which gives me an idea of what it feels like to be aphasic. Would I be able to get by with pointing and grunting? Steve's smile seems more like a smirk, as if he's reading my mind and finding not a speck of plumbing knowledge lodged within it. Start Friday, he says. Shift is noon to 11. I think I haven't heard him right. Nor can I quite believe the wage Walt tells me I'll be getting. Not $8.50, but an incredible $10 an hour. Now I don't need Walmart anymore, I think, although it turns out they need me. Roberta calls to tell me, in fulsome tones, that my drug screen is fine, and that I'm due in tomorrow at 3 for orientation. The test result doesn't have the desired effect of making me feel absolved, or even clean. In fact, I feel irritated, and can't help wondering whether I could have gotten the same result without spending $30 and 3 days on detox and bloat. I ask her what the pay is. It should be noted that she doesn't offer this information herself. And when she says $7 an hour, I think, okay, case closed. But I decide, in the spirit of caution and inquiry, to attend the Walmart orientation anyway. This turns out, for unforeseen physiological reasons, to be another major mistake. For sheer grandeur, scale, and intimidation value, I doubt if any corporate orientation exceeds that of Walmart. I've been told that the process will take 8 hours, which will include 2 15-minute breaks and 1 half-hour break for a meal, and will be paid for like a regular shift. When I arrive, dressed neatly in khakis and clean T-shirt, as befits a potential Walmart associate, I find there are 10 new hires besides myself, mostly young and Caucasian, and a team of 3, headed by Roberta, to do the orientating. We sit around a long table in the same windowless room where I was interviewed, each with a thick folder of paperwork in front of us, and hear Roberta tell once again about raising 6 children, being a people person, discovering that the 3 principles of Walmart philosophy were the same as her own, and so on. We begin with a video, about 15 minutes long, on the history and philosophy of Walmart, or, as an anthropological observer might call it, the cult of Sam. First, young Sam Walton, in uniform, comes back from the war. He starts a store, a sort of five and dime. He marries and fathers 4 attractive children. He receives a Medal of Freedom from President Bush, after which he promptly dies, making way for the eulogies. But the company goes on, yes, indeed. Here, the arc of the story soars upward unstoppably, pausing only to mark some fresh milestone of corporate expansion. 1992. Walmart becomes the largest retailer in the world. 1997, sales top $100 billion. 1998, the number of Walmart associates hits 825,000, making Walmart the largest private employer in the nation. Each landmark date is accompanied by a clip showing throngs of shoppers, swarms of associates, or scenes of handsome new stores and their adjoining parking lots. Over and over we hear in voiceover, or see in graphic display, the 3 principles, which are maddeningly, even defiantly, non-parallel. Respect for the individual, exceeding customers' expectations, strive for excellence. Respect for the individual is where we, the associates, come in. Because vast as Walmart is, and tiny as we may be as individuals, everything depends on us. Sam always said, and is shown saying, that the best ideas come from the associates. For example, the idea of having a people greeter, an elderly employee, excuse me, associate, who welcomes each customer as he or she enters the store. Three times during the orientation, which began at 3 and stretches to nearly 11, we are reminded that this brainstorm originated in a mere associate. And who knows what revolutions in retailing each one of us may propose. Because our ideas are welcome, more than welcome, and we are to think of our managers not as bosses, but as servant leaders, serving us as well as the customers. Of course, all is not total harmony in every instance between associates and their servant leaders. A video on associate honesty shows a cashier being caught on videotape as he pockets some bills from the cash register. Drums beat ominously as he's led away in handcuffs and sentenced to 4 years. The theme of covert tensions overcome by right-thinking and positive attitude continues in the 12-minute video entitled, "You've Picked a Great Place to Work." Here, various associates testify to the essential feeling of family for which Walmart is so well known, leading up to the conclusion that we don't need a union. Once, long ago, unions had a place in American society, but they no longer have much to offer workers, which is why people are leaving them by the droves. Walmart is booming. Unions are declining. Judge for yourself. But we are warned that unions have been targeting Walmart for years. Why? For the dues money, of course. Think of what you would lose with a union. First, your dues money, which could be $20 a month, and sometimes much more. Second, you would lose your voice, because the union would insist on doing your talking for you. Finally, you might lose even your wages and benefits because they would all be at risk on the bargaining table. You have to wonder, and I imagine some of my teenage fellow orientees may be doing so, why such fiends as these union organizers, such outright extortionists, are allowed to roam free in the land? There's more. Much more than I could ever absorb, even if it were spread out over a semester-long course. On the reasonable assumption that none of us is planning to go home and curl up with the Walmart Associate Handbook, our trainers start reading it out loud to us, pausing every few paragraphs to ask, "Any questions?" There never are. Barry, the 17-year-old to my left, mutters that his butt hurts. Sonia, the tiny African-American woman across from me, seems frozen in terror. I have given up on looking perky and am fighting to keep my eyes open. No nose or other facial jewelry, we learn. Earrings must be small and discreet, not dangling. No blue jeans except on Friday, and then you have to pay a dollar for the privilege of wearing them. No grazing. That is, eating from food packages that somehow become open. No time theft. This last sends me drifting off in a sci-fi direction, and as the time thieves headed back to the year 3420, loaded with weekends and days off, looted from the 21st century, finally, a question. The old guy who's being hired as a people greeter wants to know, what is time theft? Answer, doing anything other than working during company time. Anything at all. Theft of our time is not, however, an issue. There are stretches amounting to many minutes when all three of our trainers wander off, leaving us to sit there in silence or take the opportunity to squirm. Or our junior trainers go through a section of the handbook, and then Roberta, returning from some other business, goes over the same section again. My eyelids droop, and I consider walking out. I've seen time move more swiftly during 7-hour airline delays. In fact, I'm getting nostalgic about 7-hour airline delays. At least you can read a book or get up and walk around, take a leak. On breaks, I drink coffee purchased at the Radio Grill, as the in-house fast food place is called. The real stuff with caffeine. More because I'm concerned about being alert for the late-night drive home than out of any need to absorb all the Walmart trivia coming my way. Now, here's a drug the drug warriors ought to take a little more interest in. Since I don't normally drink it at all, iced tea can usually be counted on for enough of a kick. The coffee has an effect like a reagent-grade dexedrine. My pulse races, my brain overheats, and the result in this instance is a kind of delirium. I find myself overly challenged by the little kindergarten-level tasks we're now given to do, such as affixing my personal barcode to my ID card, then sticking on the punch-out letters to spell my name. The letters keep curling up and sticking to my fingers, so I stop at Barb, drifting off to think of all the people I know who have gentrified their names in recent years, Patsy to Patricia, Dick to Richard, and so forth, while I'm going in the other direction. Now we start taking turns going to the computers to begin our CBL, or computer-based learning, and I become transfixed by the HIV-inspired module entitled Bloodborne Pathogens, on what to do in the event that pools of human blood should show up on the sales floor. All right. You put warning cones around the puddles, don protective gloves, etc. But I can't stop trying to envision the circumstances in which these pools might arise. An associate uprising? A guest riot? I've gone through 6 modules, 3 more than we're supposed to do tonight. The rest are to be done in our spare moments over the next few weeks, when one of the trainers gently pries me away from the computer. We are allowed now to leave. There follows the worst of many sleepless nights to come. On the drive home along the interstate, a guy doing over 80 passes me on the right at a few angstroms distance, making the point that any highway has far more exits than you can see, infinitely many. Final exits, that is. At this hour, which is nearly midnight, it takes me 15 minutes to find a parking place, and another 5 to walk to the apartment, where I find that Budgie, distraught by my long absence, has gone totally postal. Feathers litter the floor under his cage, and he refuses to return to it, even after a generous 45 minutes of head time. I want to be fresh for my first day in plumbing tomorrow. Menards is still my choice. But a lot of small things have been going wrong. And at this level of finances, nothing wrong is ever quite small enough. My watch battery ran out, and I had to spend $11 to get it replaced. My khakis developed a prominent ink stain that took 3 wash cycles, $3.75, and a treatment with Shout Gel, $1.29, to remove. There was the $20 application fee at the Park Plaza, plus $20 for the belt I need for Menards, purchased only after comparison shopping at a consignment store. And why hadn't I asked what that knife and tape measure are going to cost? I discover that the phone is no longer taking incoming calls or recording voicemail, so who knows what housing opportunities I have missed. Around 2 in the morning, I pop a Unisom to counteract the still raging caffeine. But at 5, Budgie takes his revenge, greeting the prospect of dawn, which is still comfortably remote, with a series of scandalized squawks. I'm due at Menards at noon. At this point, although I haven't formally accepted either job, I realize I'm officially employed at both places, Walmart and Menards. Maybe I'll combine both jobs, or just blow off Walmart and go for the better money at Menards. But Walmart, with its endless orientation, has, alas, already sunk its talons into me. People working more than one job, and, in effect, I would be doing that for a day, by going from my 3-to-11 stint at Walmart to a day at Menards, have to take sleep deprivation in stride. I do not. I am shaky. My brain fried like that egg in the Partnership for a Drug-Free America commercial. How am I going to master the science of plumbing products when I can barely summon the concentration required to assemble a breakfast of peanut butter and toast? The world is coming at me in high-contrast snapshots, deprived of narrative continuity. I call Menards and get Paul on the line to clear up what exactly my shift is supposed to be. Steve, or was it Walt, said noon till 11, but that would be 11 hours, right? Right, he says. You want to be full-time, don't you? And you're going to pay me $10 an hour? $10, Paul says. Who told you 10? He'll have to check on that. It can't be right. Now, thoroughly unnerved, I tell him I'm not working an 11-hour shift, not without time and a half after 8. I don't tell him about the generations of workers who fought and sometimes died for the 10-hour day and then the 8, although this is very much on my mind. I just tell him I'm going to send my knife, my vest, and my tape measure back. In the days that follow, I will try to rationalize this decision by telling myself that, given Walmart's position as the nation's largest private employer, whatever I experience there will at least be of grand social significance. But this is just a way of prettifying yet another dumb mistake, the one involving all that coffee. The embarrassing truth is that I am just too exhausted to work, especially for 11 hours in a row. Under the Fair Labor Standards Act, it is in fact illegal not to pay time and a half for hours worked above 40 hours a week. Certain categories of workers, professionals, managers, and farm workers, are not covered by the FLSA, but retail workers are not among them. Why hadn't I asked all these questions about wages and hours before? For that matter, why hadn't I bargained with Roberta when she called to tell me I'd passed the drug test? Told her $7 an hour would be fine, as long as the benefits included a free lakeside condo with hot tub. At least part of the answer, which I only figured out weeks later, lies in the employer's deft handling of the hiring process. First, you are an applicant. Then suddenly, you're an orientee. You're handed the application form, and a few days later, you're being handed the uniform and warned against nose rings and stealing. There's no intermediate point in the process in which you confront the potential employer as a free agent, entitled to cut her own deal. The intercalation of the drug test between application and hiring tilts the playing field even further, establishing that you, and not the employer, are the one who has something to prove. Even in the tightest labor market, and it doesn't get any tighter than Minneapolis, where I would probably have been welcome to apply at any commercial establishment I entered, the person who has precious labor to sell can be made to feel one down, way down, like a supplicant with her hand stretched out. It's Saturday, and the time has come to leave my free lodgings and neurotic avian roommate. A few hours before my hosts are scheduled to return, I pack up and head down to Twin Lakes where, no big surprise, I find out that all the second-story rooms have been taken. The particular room I'd requested, which looks out on a backyard instead of a parking lot, is now occupied by a woman with a child, the owner tells me, and he is good enough to feel uncomfortable about asking them to move to a smaller one. So I decide that this is my out, and call another weekly rental place on my list, the Clearview Inn, not its real name, which has two big advantages. It's about a 20-minute drive from my Walmart, as opposed to at least 45 in the case of Twin Lakes, and the weekly rate is $2.45 compared to $2.95. This is still scandalously high. Higher, in fact, than my after-tax weekly pay will amount to. But in our latest conversation, Hildy has promised me a room with a kitchenette by the end of next week, and I'm confident I can get a weekend job at the supermarket I applied to, in bakery, if I'm lucky. To say that someplace is the worst motel in the country is, of course, to set oneself up for considerable challenge. Although I may have to withdraw my claim. Until it was closed for fire code violations in 1997, the Parkway Motel in southern Maryland boasted exposed electrical wires, holes in room doors, and raw sewage on bathroom floors. But if price entered into the competition, the Clearview Inn may still win, since the Parkway was charging only $20 a day at the time. Now, I have encountered plenty of contenders in my own travels. The one in Cleveland that turned into a brothel at night. The one in Butte, where the window looked out into another room. Still, the Clearview Inn leaves the competition in the dust. I slide $255 in cash, the extra $10 is for telephone service, under the glass window that separates me from the young East Indian owner. East Indians seem to have a lock on the Midwestern motel business, and am taken by his wife to a room memorable only for its overwhelming stench of mold. I don't have enough Claritin D for this situation, a point I have to make by holding my nose, since her English doesn't extend to the concept of allergy. Air freshener? She suggests when she catches my meaning. Incense? There is a better room, her husband says when we return to the office, but, and here he fixes me with a narrow-eyed stare, I'd better not trash it. I attempt a reassuring chuckle, but the warning rankles for days. Have I been fooling myself all these years? Thinking I look like a mature and sober person, when in fact anyone can see I'm a vandal? Room 133 contains a bed, a chair, a chest of drawers, and a TV fastened to the wall. I plead for and get a lamp to supplement the single overhead bulb. Instead of the mold smell, I now breathe a mixture of fresh paint and what I eventually identify as mouse droppings. But the real problems are all window and door related. The single small window has no screen, and the room has no AC or fan. The curtain is transparently thin, the door has no bolt. Without a screen, the window should be sensibly closed at night, meaning no air. Unless I'm willing to take my chances with the bugs and the neighbors. Who are the neighbors? The motel forms a toilet seat shape around the parking lot, and I can see an inexplicable collection. A woman with a baby in her arms leans in the doorway of one room. Two bunches of teenagers, one group black and the other white, seem to share adjoining rooms. There are several unencumbered men of various ages, including an older white man in work clothes whose bumper sticker says, "Don't steal. The government hates competition." As if the income tax were the only thing keeping him from living at the Embassy Suites right now. When it gets dark, I go outside and look through my curtain, and yes, you can see pretty much everything, at least in silhouette. I eat the deli food I have brought with me from a Minneapolis supermarket and go to bed with my clothes on, but not to sleep. I am not a congenitally fearful person, for which you can blame or credit my mother, who never got around to alerting me to any special vulnerabilities that went with being a girl. Only when I got to college did I begin to grasp what rape involves, and discover that my custom of exploring strange cities alone, on foot, day or night, looked more reckless to others than eccentric. I had no misgivings about the trailer park in Key West, or the motel in Maine, but the trailer's door had a bolt, and both had effective shades and screens. Here, only the stuffiness of the air with the window shut reminds me that I'm really indoors. Otherwise, I'm pretty much open to anyone's view, or to anything that might drift in from the highway, and I wouldn't want to depend on my hosts for help. I think of wearing earplugs to block out the TV sounds from the next room, and my sleep mask to cut the light from the Dr. Pepper sign on the pop machine in the parking lot. Then I decide it's smarter to keep all senses on ready alert. I sleep and wake up, sleep and wake up again. Listen to the cars coming and going. Watch the silhouettes move past my window. Sometime around 4 in the morning, it dawns on me that it's not just that I'm a wimp. Poor women, perhaps especially single ones, and even those who are just temporarily living among the poor for whatever reason, really do have more to fear than women who have houses with double locks and alarm systems and husbands or dogs. I must have known this theoretically, or at least heard it stated. But now, for the first time, the lesson takes hold. So, this is the home from which I go forth on Monday to begin my life as a Walmartian. After the rigors of orientation, I am expecting a highly structured welcome, perhaps a ceremonial donning of my bright blue Walmart vest, and a 45-minute training on the operation of the vending machines in the break room. But when I arrive in the morning for the 10-to-6 shift, no one seems to be expecting me. I'm in soft lines, which has a wonderful sinuous sound to it, but I have no idea what it means. Someone in personnel tells me I'm in ladies' wear, a division of soft lines, I learn, and sends me to the counter next to the fitting rooms, where I am passed around from one person to the next, finally ending up with Ellie, whose lack of a vest signals that she's management. She sets me to work, zoning the Bobby Brooks knit summer dresses, a task that could serve as an IQ test for the severely cognitively challenged. First, the dresses must be grouped by color, olive, peach, or lavender in this case, then by decorative pattern, the leafy design on the bodice, the single flower or the grouped flowers, and within each pattern by size. When I am finished, though hardly exhausted by the effort, I meet Melissa, who is, with only a couple of weeks on the job, pretty much my equivalent. She asks me to help her consolidate the Kathy Lee knit dresses so the Kathy Lee silky ones can take their place at the Image, a high-traffic corner area. I learn, in a couple of hours of scattered exchanges, that Melissa was a waitress before this job, that her husband works in construction and her children are grown. There have been some disorganized patches in her life, an out-of-wedlock child, a problem with alcohol and drugs, but that's all over now that she's given her life to Christ. Our job, it emerges in fragments throughout the day, is to keep ladies' wear shoppable. Sure, we help customers, who are increasingly called guests here as well, if they want any help. At first, I go around practicing the aggressive hospitality demanded by our training videos. As soon as anyone comes within 10 feet of a sales associate, that associate is supposed to smile warmly and offer assistance. But I never see a more experienced associate do this. First, because the customers are often annoyed to have their shopping days interrupted, and second, because we have far more pressing things to do. In ladies' wear, the big task, which has no real equivalent in, say, housewares or lawn and garden, is to put away the returns, clothes that have been tried on and rejected, or, more rarely, purchased and then returned to the store. There are also the many items that have been scattered by customers, dropped on the floor, removed from their hangers and strewn over the racks, or secreted in locations far from their natural homes. Each of these items, too, must be returned to its precise place, matched by color, pattern, price, and size. Any leftover time is to be devoted to zoning. When I relate this to Carolyn on the phone, she commiserates, "Ugh, a no-brainer." But no job is as easy as it looks to the uninitiated. I have to put clothes away. The question is, where? Much of my first few days is devoted to trying to memorize the layout of ladies' wear. 1,000, 2,000 square feet of space bordered by menswear, children's wear, greeting cards, and underwear. Standing at the fitting rooms and facing toward the main store entrance, we are looking directly at the tent-like utilitarian plus sizes, also known as woman sizes. These are flanked on the left by our dressiest and costliest line, going up to $29 and change. The all-polyester Kathy Lee collection, suitable for dates and sub-professional levels of office work. Moving clockwise, we encounter the determinedly sexless Russ and Bobby Brooks lines, seemingly aimed at pudgy fourth-grade teachers with important barbecues to attend. Then, after the sturdy white stag, come the breezy, revealing, faded glory, no boundaries, and Jordache collections, designed for the younger and thinner crowd. Tucked throughout are nests of the lesser brands, such as Athletic Works, Basic Equipment, and the whimsical Looney Tunes, Pooh, and Mickey lines, generally decorated with images of their eponymous characters. Within each brand name area, there are, of course, dozens of items, even dozens of each kind of item. This summer, for example, pants may be capri, classic, carpenter, clam digger, boot, or flood, depending on their length and cut, and I'm probably leaving a few categories out. So my characteristic stance is one of rotating slowly on one foot, eyes wide, garment in hand, asking myself, where have I seen the $9.96 Athletic Works knit overalls? Or similar query. Inevitably, there are mystery items requiring extra time and inquiry. Clothes that have wandered over from girls or men's. Clearanced items whose tags haven't been changed to reflect their new prices. The occasional one of a kind. Then, when I have the layout memorized, it suddenly changes. On my third morning, I find, after a few futile searches, that the Russ shirt and short combinations have edged Kathy Lee out of her image. When I groaningly accuse Ellie of trying to trick me into thinking I'm getting Alzheimer's, she's genuinely apologetic, explaining that the average customer shops the store 3 times a week, so you need to have the element of surprise. Besides, the layout is about the only thing she can control, since the clothes, and at least the starting prices, are all determined by the home office in Arkansas. So, as fast as I can memorize, she furiously rearranges. My first response to the work is disappointment, and a kind of sexist contempt. I could have been in plumbing, mastering the vocabulary of valves, dangling tools from my belt, joshing around with Steve and Walt. And instead, the mission of the moment is to return a pink bikini top to its place on the Bermuda swimwear rack. Nothing is heavy, or, as far as I can see, very urgent. No one will go hungry or die or be hurt if I screw up. In fact, how would anyone ever know if I screwed up, given the customer's constant depredations? I feel oppressed, too, by the mandatory gentility of Walmart culture. This is ladies, and we are all ladies here, forbidden by a store-wide rule to raise our voices or cuss. Give me a few weeks of this and I'll femme out entirely. My stride will be reduced to a mince. I'll start tucking my head down to one side. My job is not, however, as genteel as it first appears, thanks to the sheer volume of clothing in motion. At Walmart, as opposed to, say, Lord & Taylor, customers shop with supermarket-style shopping carts, which they can fill to the brim before proceeding to the fitting room. There, the rejected items, which are about 90% of try-ons, are folded and put on hangers by whoever's staffing the fitting room, then placed in fresh shopping carts for Melissa and me. So this is how we measure our workload. In carts. When I get in, Melissa, whose shift begins earlier than mine, will tell me how things have been going. Can you believe? 8 carts this morning. And how many carts are awaiting me? At first, a cart takes me an average of 45 minutes, and there may still be 3 or 4 mystery items left at the bottom. I get this down to half an hour, and still the carts keep coming. Most of the time, the work requires minimal human interaction of either the